Hello, hello. I hope everyone's been staying safe and sane during this lockdown winter holiday period. If over this quiet period, you've been existentially thinking about what career you're aspiring towards after slogging through years of law school, or what meaningful extracurricular activities you can get involved in over the next semester, then this is the episode for you.
This season of Footnotes, we're exploring a new theme of social justice in the law, because I'm sure there's many of us who are keen to pursue this either as a career or are just generally interested in this topic. This will be our first episode exploring the theme, focused on social justice volunteering experiences available for law students at our university.
Welcome to Footnotes, a legal podcast run by students for students, breaking down the law and all its complexities one chat at a time. I'm Vivienne, here with my co-host Kathy, and we'll be your hosts for this episode. So a lot of us law students become fixated on gaining external professional work experiences, such as paralegal positions, but overlook the valuable opportunities that are available right here at the university. These include the social justice units that we can gain credit for, or the volunteering opportunities that SELS links us up with, like the Refugee Learning Program or the Juvenile Justice Mentoring Scheme. Today, we'll be chatting with students who have been involved or are currently involved in these programs to get some insights. So, Kathy, what is your experience with social justice and volunteering?
I've been volunteering at Marrickville Legal Centre for around a year now. I applied independently during their recruitment drive, but I know that it's also available through the Public Interest Law Clinic. So formally at MLC, I am a client intake officer, but informally I am a receptionist. So essentially when someone comes to the legal centre with an inquiry, I'm the one who interviews them and gets their details down for the solicitors. I think the programs at uni are very similar in the sense that they give you a chance to experience things that you might never come into contact with.
That's great to hear. And do you feel like it's been valuable for your career as well?
Absolutely. I think these kinds of experiences are a great stepping stone for more competitive professional positions because you're able to learn so much, not just from the role, but also from the people around you.
Yeah, it sounds like a good entry pathway for any career, not just if you're interested in social justice, and something solid to have on your resume. It's also great to just explore the array of opportunities that are right here available at the uni, instead of always externally looking for opportunities, because they're really valuable and shouldn't be overlooked. So to dive into the details of these opportunities, we have four guests with us today. Our first guest is Professor Simon Rice, who has had a career in social justice, has been a board member for several legal centres, and has advised on the Federal Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights. Professor, you've dedicated a life to social justice and certainly carved a mark in the field with your numerous achievements. Can you tell us, please, what sparked your interest in social justice in the first place? What your career has been like so far, noting some career highlights?
Yes, Vivienne. I think the first thing on reflection is that my interest in social justice is personal. I think we all have our values. It takes us a while to work out what they are and how they fit, but that's me, that's who I am, that's what I was interested in. I think the real challenge was for me finding a place for them, like finding somewhere where I felt comfortable with my values. And that fortunately for me happened at law school when I volunteered at Redfern Legal Centre as a student. I then did a clinic course at Kingsford Legal Centre at UNSW. So that helped me confirm and express that sense I had of that social justice was important. So when I followed the usual path and graduated and went off and did a summer clerkship, and then I got a job in a commercial firm, I was happy doing the work. It was intellectually interesting and I was working with nice people and I was earning money and I was in the city and I had a suit and everything was as it should be, except it was not lighting a fire in my belly. It wasn't engaging me emotionally. So I suppose in a way that confirmed that my early instincts were right and that I felt more connected with my values working in a different environment. And that's when I left the city and a suit and the income and went off on a different path. So the short answer to your question is, I think the social justice drive is a personal one, but it can be ignited and validated by those kind of experiences. And I was fortunate that I had them when I was a law student.
I think that resonates with a lot of us. I think a lot of people, especially enter law school from high school, wanting to go into social justice. And then throughout law school, I think maybe because of the lack of knowledge available as to the social justice careers out there, and commercial law being, I guess, the most straightforward path, people just kind of go into that.
Yeah. It's hard when what's presented to you actively and to a significant degree passively is a particular path, because implicit in that is that, you know, that path is endorsed as not merely valid or legitimate, but preferable and desirable. There's a sort of hierarchy. And if people aren't talking about certain options and pathways, then impliedly, they're not worth talking about. And I have real sympathy for students in an environment where they're not being offered diversity, choice, a range of options. And I can really see that students do struggle with that. So it's important that we try really hard to not to devalue or negate the options that are there, the few limited options, but to broaden them and to say other things are possible, other things that may engage you and your intellect and your emotions.
Yeah, definitely. And so where did you go after leaving your commercial law firm, and what have been some career highlights?
Well, look, I had continued to volunteer at Redfern Legal Centre, and that was a long time ago, but that option is still there, and the option is there more broadly. There are other legal centres. I could have at the time volunteered at others like Marrickville and Inner City, just for where I was studying over in Kensington. There are lots of those opportunities. And so that's what enabled me to step out of or away from the commercial path, because I had a foot in the door. I was a volunteer. I applied for a job. I had a bit of a track record of working in that sector, so I wasn't an unknown quantity. And I had a bit of experience, because legal centre work is very demanding, and there isn't a lot of room for people to learn on the job. So having a bit of experience under my belt helped, I think. I was fortunate getting that job. It's still a very small field. There's still highly competitive. Legal aid is highly competitive. But on the other hand, there are more options. There's community legal centres. There's a whole range of NGOs. You don't actually have to be a lawyer to do this work. So to put the two together, I managed to make that step because I'd been volunteering, because I knew the sector and I could make that transition. And I think these days that's still the case. Being involved beforehand for a period as a volunteer or as a paralegal or as a PLT student opens up those doorways for you.
Definitely. And so human rights is such a broad, overarching topic. I note that in your biography, you've worked particularly in poverty law and anti-discrimination law. Yeah. Personally, I had no idea that poverty law was actually a field. So are there any specific human rights works that you're particularly interested in, and how has that manifested in your work so far?
Okay, I'll just pick up on the poverty law point. You're quite right. People don't say poverty now. And they should, because it hasn't gone away and it's still what it always was. Some social service workers, council social service, produce poverty reports. People still use that term to identify people who simply can't afford to keep up with society, can't afford the security of housing, security of education, of food. So my first job at Redfern Legal Centre was actually called poverty lawyer. And that's because I was concerned with the legal dimensions of people who didn't have secure housing, didn't have secure employment, didn't have good health, couldn't ensure education for their children. And I still think that's an issue, but it's not a term that is used. So these days, I think if we were to say poverty law, we're talking about people working in housing, social security, employment, health, those sort of things. That's not necessarily human rights. I think you can do people, particularly I think law students within the law school, have a an artificially narrow idea of what human rights are. Human rights look like they're the things that come out of the United Nations. And they certainly are. That's the touchstone, you know, that's the framework we work with. But everything we've just been talking about are in fact human rights. And I went down a particular path focusing on anti-discrimination. Non-discrimination is a core human right. Employment, shelter, housing, education are all human rights. So when I talk to students about careers in human rights, I actually encourage them to think in those terms. You don't find a job in Australia which is working with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. There are about a dozen people in Australia who can say that's their job.
Yeah.
But you do get people who work in labour law on workers' rights, in personal injury law on, again, on often on workers' rights, in family law on children's rights. So it's a question of how you characterise, I think, your interests. Social justice is another way of thinking of human rights, or human rights is another way of thinking of social justice. And if we're not narrow about it, if we're broad and we start from this idea of social justice, of fairness and equality, then that takes us into all the areas that human rights works.
I think human rights is almost like a buzzword in our generation. And yeah, we do think about it quite narrowly. Earlier, I was just thinking about like, what is a human right? And it was just such a basic question, but it was a question I couldn't really like simply answer.
It's hard in Australia too, because in Australia generally, not only are you and our students in the small and comfortable world of Sydney University and Sydney Law School, we're in Australia that doesn't have a human rights cultural language. We wouldn't have this degree of uncertainty and angst in almost any other developed country in the world, because we'd be much more comfortable with what human rights really means. Mm-hmm. We still have human rights in this very formal framework instead of being something that occurs in life. So we don't see criminal law as human rights, but if we were in Europe, criminal law is human rights, and we're just unsophisticated in our understanding of it.
We definitely think about it, I think, in terms of extremes, something that's outside of, you know, the cushy, like developed nation of Australia. Yeah. With the human rights field, what challenges have you faced in your work?
Well, if we're particularly in human rights, as I said, I've been working in anti-discrimination law on the ground. That's been the legal practice. And then in policy areas, I've worked in human rights more generally around government policy and practices. Well, I just mentioned, I think for me, the greatest challenge has been and will always be to get human rights taken seriously in Australia as a valid constraint on state power and as a valid framework through which to evaluate state conduct. It just doesn't get traction in Australia, and I don't know when and how that will happen. Even in the jurisdictions, ACT, Victoria and Queensland, where there's a Human Rights Act, it's a very slow process to translate that idea of human rights into popular understanding and culture. So the biggest challenge has been to popularize and the idea of human rights and have it taken seriously. I think within that, the next biggest challenge I think I've faced is to get Australia to face up to issues of race, discrimination, inequality, both in relation to our Indigenous peoples and to migrant communities. It's just, again, something that we don't want to have to address. It disturbs our comfort. It confronts us with truths that we can actually afford to avoid. And I don't feel that's something I've had any great success in.
And on that point about it being a challenge to popularize human rights as a legitimate field to work in and to be concerned in Australia, I guess this podcast and this episode would help students kind of realize the opportunities that are out there. For those students who wish to work in this social justice field, what type of opportunities are available?
Yeah, that's difficult because Australia is a small place, so it's a small market, and it's a small unsophisticated market. So I think you have to think broadly and imaginatively. Essentially, I said before, not entirely flippantly, there's a dozen people in Australia who work with the United Nations conventions. Really, you know, you can get a job at the Human Rights Commission, in the Attorney General's Department, and in a couple of NGOs that have human rights advocates, but outside the human rights offices in Victoria, ACT and Queensland and nationally, and those few NGOs, pure human rights jobs are rare.
Mm-hmm.
But more broadly, you can think of a commitment to human rights as being manifest in working for the Aboriginal Legal Service, in working in a small suburban criminal law defence practice, in working in a suburban family law practice, in working in a labour rights practice. They're all dimensions of human rights. Mm-hmm. If you think intellectually what you want to work with is the UN conventions, then you're narrowing your scope, but you might want to become an academic, you might want to go to Geneva, but it's a very narrow field. If what you want to do is work in a way that helps people who are marginalized, oppressed, disadvantaged, and you call that social justice and you see that in human rights terms, then a lot of legal practice and a lot of community practice is addressed to that. So I think, again, it comes back to the signals you're given at law school. How legitimate is it to graduate from Sydney Law School and aspire to work for a community-based NGO that provides food and shelter to homeless people? Mm-hmm. That just doesn't look like a Sydney Uni law graduate job. And yet that's the kind of thing that so many of our students would get real professional and emotional satisfaction from doing. And we need to make that a real and legitimate career option.
Yeah, definitely. I know a girl personally who has interned at the UN, and kind of that, those sort of experiences, there's a lot of barriers to that, not only entry, but the fact that a lot of UN opportunities at the very start are unpaid as well. And there's not many opportunities in Australia. So you have to go all the way to Europe, not be paid, and just live out of your own savings, which is...
Yeah, people don't realise how fragile the UN is, how dependent it is on unpaid interns. Like, we're talking, not exaggerating, around the world, thousands of unpaid interns keeping the UN going. The other thing about working about the UN, about working there, and is it's a great aspiration, and if you have the opportunity, you take it, is you're removed from the front line. You're not actually... You're involved in a bureaucracy, and that can be very instructive, and you can feel that you're achieving something to a point, but it is very removed from the reality of people's situation. It's very different from working in NGOs or even working in government services. You know, the UN is a vast bureaucracy that does vitally important work in setting standards and frameworks, but it's mostly for interns or for graduates removed from the front line.
Definitely. And so what kind of advice would you give students who wish to work in this space then?
Coming from what I've just said, that some of the threads are engage as soon as you can and as much as you can, volunteering, because you get credibility. You know, it's a because it's a small market, it's a competitive field, and just to be strategic about it, you want a CV that shows that you're not just dreaming, that you actually have practiced it. So yeah, volunteer, get engaged in almost anything with that social justice perspective, and do it for a while so that you can start taking responsibility. You move up very quickly in this field because it's under-resourced. You can actually stay with an agency as a volunteer for a few years and find yourself taking quite a bit of responsibility. So that would be the first thing. Then I think, as I say, be brave and step outside the path and take another option. Really, a Sydney Uni law degree is a passport. How can you go wrong? Mm-hmm. And I say that regardless of grades. Okay, grades matter to some. I know grades matter when we're talking about a particular path. But if this conversation is about a diversity of paths, then those sort of constraints fall away. More interesting to a prospective employer in social justice is what you studied, what you did, what your values are, what you want to do, and you have a Sydney law degree. So yes, two things: volunteer and try and be brave in the choices you make. One thing that I'm often asked, Vivian, is whether to take the conventional option first, particularly if you're on track to getting a summer clerkship and getting a graduate job, and how do you say no to that? But at the same time, how does that fit with your aspiration to work in social justice? I don't tell people not to take those options. I think you can take those options for a number of good reasons. You learn skills because the social justice sector is under-resourced and has to demand a lot of you, whereas if you've had corporate experience, you have a good idea of how good systems work, how good processes work, how good organizations work. So you get skills, you get some money, which is more you're going to get when you go off and work for social justice. You get really good networks and colleagues and friends. I still have people who I can call on and contact from my time in commercial legal practice. So it's not something you should avoid. It's just something you need to go into with your eyes open. You can't afford to let go of your volunteering that keeps you grounded. I'll be honest, I don't take seriously any of the claims that the law firms make to giving you the latitude to pursue your social justice aspirations. It's always constrained by commercial imperatives. So it's admirable what the firms try and do, and you do get to do some interesting things, but ultimately it's a business. And you'll be involved in the business. So if you go down that path, you simply need to go down that path with your eyes open and a resolve to take what you can get from it and get out.
Professor, that's really inspiring. And I think it's good to keep in mind that everyone's career path is really flexible and that you can change your mind whenever, according to what you feel like.
Yeah, and look, I don't want to sound too glib about that. People have constraints. They have financial constraints. They have personal circumstances. They have expectations around them, and that's why I said before it does require a degree of bravery, and it's quite understandable that some people simply can't make those choices as readily as others. The really important message is, just as you said, that there is a choice there to be made, and a lot of our education doesn't suggest you that there are choices. That's the real message we have to get through.
Thank you for those pearls of wisdom, Professor. Now, let's chat about some ways for you to gain that practical experience and set you up for a possible career path in social justice. Next, I chat to Vaidehi, who is a fifth-year Ing's Law student who has just completed a law elective called SLIC, or Service Learning in Indigenous Communities, and has most recently gone to the Torres Strait to participate in an immersive local project. Welcome, Vaidehi. Can you please tell us briefly about what the unit aims to help students achieve, what project you were involved with, and what you did over the course of the semester?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, Vivian. So it's all about helping students gain some sort of insight and a deeper understanding of certain Indigenous or Torres Strait Islander communities in Australia. I, like a lot of the students in my cohort, have had very little, knowledge going into the subject and just a real passion to learn about it. So that's what the unit really aims to help students achieve. It's just about getting students into communities, into experiences that they have had no opportunity to have, and to help them be well-rounded, better people in general. Oh my God, that was a long question.
No, there was like three kind of segments to it. So sure. That's what the unit kind of aims to help students achieve.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about your project in particular, because it changes, right, over like every single semester, depending on what the community needs.
Yes.
So what project were you involved in and what did you actually do?
Sure. So this semester, I was involved in a project with the Torres Strait Island Regional Council with their community services team. So we have 15 students working on that project, and our goal is to assist each community services manager in providing a research report that fits with their aims and objectives for the 2021-2022 year ahead. Mm-hmm. So the project I'm specifically working on is about environmental health. So looking at how the community's interactions with their environment are impacting human health and the challenges associated with that, and also the strengths of the program. So it's really just gaining a lot of insight into how a local council operates, the kind of parameters they're working within and the challenges they face, as well as what unique aspects of the community that they're operating in enables that council to do work that might not really occur in other parts of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's super interesting in that way. And what I did over the course of the semester, so it started off slightly before semester. So there was a three-day workshop in family wellbeing, which is a program where you're learning about things like leadership and culturally safe and respectful communication and relationships. So that was a nice foundation which to start the semester on. And then we went into the first 5 weeks were lectures about starting off quite broad, a global perspective on Indigenous communities, Indigenous histories and activism, and then narrowing in on the experiences of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities pre and post colonial invasion. And in the mid-sem break in week six, so for 12 days, we actually went out into communities. So the 15 of us, as well as our academic supervisors, traveled to the Torres Strait. We spent a few days in Cairns first, where we were interviewing members, so people working in the council, as well as we then spent 8 days in the Torres Strait Islands, mainly on Wyben or Thursday Island, just conducting interviews with community elders, the community service managers and divisional managers and so on, all these people in TCIRC working on the different islands. And yeah, just gathering as much information as we could.
Okay, that's really interesting. And 12 days is a really long period to be immersed in like a new environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the things that really surprised you when you were over there, either because they were positive or because they were really challenging or different to what you expected?
Sure. So one of the biggest positives was the people. They were so friendly. I mean, Australia's already known for being very friendly, like strangers on the street will walk past and say good morning and say hello. But here it was that, but times 10. Everyone was so generous with their time and being willing to share their experiences and their stories with us, which was so touching. And then just people on the street or people you'd meet at the pub at dinner and so on were just really interested in what we were doing there and just why we'd come so far from Sydney. So that was really lovely. One of the highlights for me personally was we visited the Thursday Island Aged Care Association, which is this organization that aims to promote independent living of the older members of the community there. Mm-hmm. And so they do a lot of crafts and scrapbooking and so on there. So we were reading through scrapbooks created by community members, and we like, they were making jewelry there, and so we bought some jewelry. And all of that goes back to fund that organization. And before we left, some of the clients there performed a song for us, which did generate a few tears. So those are definitely some highlights. And yeah, I mean, I think I learned, it did put some perspective to some realities there. So before going, we did do our research. Just, we had an assignment before we went, learning about, there's a big focus on health, because Professor Melissa Haswell, who is one of the academic supervisors and the one in charge of the Torres Strait Project, she has a public health background. So a lot of what she's teaching us has a holistic health component. And so we're learning about things like the impact of heat on the community and how heat is actually the biggest killer in the Torres Strait. And then also how diabetes is so prolific in those communities, even in really, really young children. And so we're listening to these and we're reading reports. And so we're aware of it, but going there and actually experiencing that heat that makes you not want to go outside and exercise, probably not even safe to exercise in the middle of the day heat like that. And this was April. It wasn't even the middle of summer.
Yeah.
And then, you know, going to the grocery store and the fresh produce was so expensive, but also not of the same quality that you'd find at your Woolies here because of the transit time. So what you buy, if you buy a head of lettuce in the Torres Strait, even if you put in your fridge, it's probably spoiling in a couple of days, as opposed to here you could keep for a week or so, right?
Yeah.
So just things like that, learning about what are some health barriers there and why are people experiencing the health issues that they are, it's not always within individual control. It's not as easy as saying, oh, you should just exercise some more, you should eat more fresh food. There's so many other economic issues and climate-related issues that all feed into it. So I definitely wouldn't have really understood that if I hadn't gone.
And so how has this experience changed your perception of Indigenous culture and the challenges that they face?
So in one word, a lot. Two words, a lot. So perceptions of Indigenous culture, I think it's just doing this subject has shown me how much diversity there is in even within communities and across communities. I think as a non-Indigenous Australian, prior to this subject, I'd always kind of an understanding of Indigenous culture as, you know, one big conglomerate. Or just when it's not, it's so many smaller, intricate, unique aspects. And in the Torres Strait Islands, so there's 15 inhabited islands, and each island has a slightly different flair to it, slightly different customs and traditions that they're following. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is one thing that I've really learned about Indigenous culture. Maybe it's not even correct to say Indigenous culture. There's Indigenous cultures.
Yeah.
Okay, challenges that they face. I think I've just learned that with those challenges, they're so multifaceted. And there's the reason why these challenges persist are because there's not one answer. So many things throughout the entire structure have to change in order to actually solve one problem or one challenge that they're facing. So it's just really given me a reality check, I think.
Yeah.
Sobering and not altogether the most encouraging, but also I think a really important one if I'm ever to go into a situation where I want to make effective change.
And so in terms of the entire experience and applying for the process, what advice would you give to students who are considering applying?
So one thing is, I think applications for next semester have already opened. So, for example, to do semester one project this year, I submitted an expression of interest, I believe, by the end of November last year. And so with that application, being honest about how much or how little experience or exposure you might have with knowing or learning about Indigenous issues, and also just showing your passion for it. Why are you interested? That's one thing. If you're considering applying, definitely do. It is... quite hard in that emotionally it is hard, I'm not gonna lie. There were several moments on the trip where I just felt quite overwhelmed, and I sat back and I was just thinking that there are so many challenges that these communities are facing that are due to structures that are so big, and they're stemming from, you know, centuries of colonization and genocide and ongoing obstinance to not acknowledge and apologize and actually make true reparations. So you can feel so insignificant and hopeless sometimes. So just be prepared for those moments, but also to really appreciate the resilience of these communities, because they have so much strength that we don't see, but that is how they're keeping their culture all alive despite so many structures being against them. Also, probably one thing I should mention is, I mean, I'm doing this as a law elective and I'm not doing any law. Like, it's not a law subject, at least not these projects I'm doing right now. So it is important to know that it's really taking a service learning and practical approach and community-led approach, and it's not taking the academic law approach per se. But just be aware, if anyone's going into it thinking you're going to change legislation, doing a lot of research into constitutional recognition, very important things, but probably not the place for it.
Yeah, but maybe in the future. Thank you so much for sharing your experience today, Maggie.
So now let's take a look at some volunteering opportunities available within our university. First up is the Juvenile Justice Mentoring Scheme, also known as the JJMS, a program run by Souls that connects volunteer mentors to young offenders. To help us learn a bit more about JJMS, we've invited Tatiana Newman-Murphy to join us for a chat today. Currently, Tat is a third-year JD student, having also completed her undergraduate degree at UCID. Tat began as a mentor with JJMS in July 2019 and has been serving as one of the co-chairs of the program since August 2020. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tat. We're super excited to have you. So to start us off, could you tell us a little about why you initially became involved with JJMS and what you've done with the program so far?
Sure. So what sparked my interest was that it was an experience that I didn't think was possible. And I just really wanted to be part of something like it. What I did as a mentor was I worked in small groups with other mentors, and we design and facilitate life skills programs. So, for example, job interviews and job application skills. transport and travel skills, budgeting skills, driving and road rules, accommodation, skills that the young people in correctional centres find useful but also fun. And now as a co-chair, I'm more focused on working with the correctional centres, interviewing potential mentors, pairing them with mentees, anything organisational, and also providing a lot of support to both the mentors and the mentees.
Thank you so much for giving us such a unique insight and insider perspective into what goes on at JJMS. So it seems that you've been involved with JJMS since essentially the beginning of your law degree. So what's kept you on and why are you passionate about JJMS?
I think I see the value for both the mentors and the mentees. In terms of the mentees, I think it's really important for these young people who have either been sentenced or on remand in correctional centres to socialise with other young people who are non-judgmental, not employed by the correctional centre. I think it's really important that these young people discuss whatever's on their mind, their future goals, become aware of possibilities and opportunities that they didn't even know about. I think also for the mentors, exposure to correctional centres and also the youth in correctional facilities, it's really important, especially if they want to work in criminal law or in the criminal justice space. It's so beneficial for them to already be working with these young people. And I think I'm so passionate about it because I see, as I said, the benefits and the values for everyone involved, but especially for me, I really do see myself working in the criminal law field and working with these young people. It challenges my own perspectives and it gives me an opportunity to reflect on my own biases that I may have and really see a different side and the behind the scenes of the criminal justice system.
Yeah, definitely. It's so important to be aware of our own internal biases, especially in the society that we live in now. It also seems that you've grown a lot since you first became involved with JJMS. Taking a look back on how it all started, what was the environment like and how did you feel the first time you were volunteering there?
Oh, I'll never forget that day because I really had no idea what to expect. I remember going there in the car with my two friends who were also had just gotten accepted into the program. We became nervous when we arrived at the correctional centre because it's quite daunting. It is a prison. It's really not meant to look like a warm, inviting space. So it was a bit intimidating. And then going through the security and the induction, that was a lot. But then as soon as we got into the unit and we met the boys, the mentees, it wasn't intimidating at all. And I'll always look back on that day and feel very proud of my friends and how they supported me, how we related to the young people. And I'll always look back on it with a lot of happiness.
So it sounds like you had quite a little emotional roller coaster there on your first day. Were you afraid that there would be some barriers in communication, especially given that you had such different life experiences to some of the boys you were going to mentor?
I was very worried about that. And to be honest, I still am concerned about that. I will never be able to understand what they've gone through because I've already passed the age that they're going through what they have. I'm older than them, so I won't be able to experience what it was like to suffer a lot of trauma at such a young age and how that impacts the way you move forward in your life. So I never wanted to feel like I was being condescending. And also I was concerned that not just my language, but me being there, I didn't want to seem like I had a savior complex. I wanted everyone to know how genuine I was about applying and being there. And so I was just very concerned about not seeming like I think I'm better than anybody, that I know what they're going through. And that's not ever something that will go away, but it's definitely something that you get better at dealing with.
Yeah, it seems like it's such a fine line to walk, especially when you kind of reflect on why you're participating in the program. And it all comes down to essentially helping the mentees that you're working with. And it's not for your own personal gratification, but I guess it's really difficult to convey that. So that was super insightful. And I guess it all just comes down to being an empathetic human being. So given that a mentor seems to require such adaptability and there are so many challenges that a mentor might need to overcome, what were some of the challenges that you faced or some of the things that were unexpected that happened to you?
As a mentor, I think one of the main challenges was designing programs that the mentees would find useful and exciting. We go on a Saturday, so the last thing they want to do is be at school. So the programs really should not come across as anything too school-like. All mentors need to keep in mind the practicality of their programs and, yeah, always keep in mind their audience. I think a major challenge that I have now as a co-chair is playing more of an observational and support role. It's really hard for me because for some people, for some mentors, it's more difficult for them to be able to communicate and sometimes not take things personally. If you enter the unit and the boys don't feel like speaking to you, that's not personal. And so you have to keep persisting. And I would always want to like be involved and make it easier for the mentors and the mentees to start communicating. But that's really what the mentors should be doing by themselves, knowing that I'm there supporting them, but I'm not there joining them. They need to learn those skills and adapt to that. And that's one of the biggest parts of the program. And also, yeah, as I said before, it's a bit of a personal struggle. It's challenging to not come across as in any way condescending with the boys. And I didn't want to seem, yeah, like I was there just to feel good about myself.
So taking a little pivot from that perspective, so can you tell us some of the skills that you've gained from participating as a mentor or any key lessons that you've learned and you'd love to share with us?
I think firstly, learning how to be more accepting and tolerant of different perspectives and adversity. And that's not just with the mentees, that's with the mentors. People will have different ideas about how programs should be run, and that's just the reality of teamwork and group work. In terms of working with the mentees, I've really been able to develop appropriate responses to very confronting situations, whether that's the stories that the mentees share, their experiences, but also confronting situations that sometimes happen in the correctional facility. I've become a better listener through this program. I've learned how to articulate advice without being judgmental and also learn when someone is asking for advice or simply when they just want to chat.
I can definitely see how there might be a bit of a steep learning curve associated with being a mentor at JJMS. Would you be all right elaborating a little bit more about one of the confronting situations that you faced before?
Yes, so it was at the end of last year, and at the time I was doing a property law essay. We were discussing, it was on the topic of shared room housing. As I was writing the essay, I was visiting the centre on one of those days, and there was a new boy who had entered the centre 2 or 3 days before. He was very happy to talk from the beginning, which is always nice and a bit unusual. A lot of the boys are very reserved. But he came up to me, started speaking to me, and I asked him how he was going. And he said that he was going really well. And essentially, what he told me was being at this correctional centre was like summer camp to him. He knew where he was going to get his food from. He knew where he was going to be sleeping that night. He knew he was going to be safe where he was sleeping. He knew who he was going to see. It was a very controlled environment and it wasn't something that he was used to, and it was something that he was obviously very desperate for. It became very clear that one of the reasons why he was in trouble in the first place was because he was in a shared room housing situation and it was very dangerous. That made me have a complete different idea of property law and criminal law and the interrelation between them, and the forces of property law that affect criminal law. And then I started thinking about how really all of the different branches of the legal system work together. Employment, property, criminal, everything. It's all one big system. And there's so many dynamics that influence each part. And it gave me a really different perspective. And it was very challenging to hear, but I'm so glad that I did hear it. I'm not glad that he's going through it, but I'm glad that I heard it because it's these situations and this knowledge that I wouldn't be able to get anywhere else, that I've only been able to get through this program, and I will take what I've learned, both the skills and also this understanding and ability to see behind the scenes of the criminal justice system. I'll take that with me for the rest of my life.
Honestly, I don't even know what I would say if I was in that situation. But it really seems that JJMS is such a unique opportunity for not only the mentors, but also the mentees. Everything that you've talked about today really shows that even though we all might know that empathy is an important trait to have and can be essential when it comes to interpersonal communication, but it can be actually so difficult to implement in practice, especially when you can't truly understand what someone's been through. And at the end of the day, all of the experiences and valuable skills that you've gained through JJMS all come down to super simple skills like being a good listener, being able to empathize with people and relate to people. And these are all such transferable skills. So no matter if, even if you're pursuing a career in criminal law or any other field, these are all skills that are going to stay with you throughout the rest of your life. So thank you so much for coming today and sharing your experiences with us. I've truly learned something new today. And I wish you the best of luck with JJMS in the future. Another valuable opportunity available at uni is the Refugee Language Program, run by the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. This program allows volunteers to help refugees improve their English language skills and break down social barriers by introducing them to Australian ideas and customs. The program is structured as weekly classes on communication skills or conversation technology and CVs, along with individual tutoring sessions. Emily Lau is a third-year LLB student here at UCID, and she has been tutoring with the Refugee Language Program since her first year. Beyond that, she was also a member of the Social Justice Committee in 2020. Welcome to the episode, Emily, and thank you so much for being so keen to share your experiences with us. Can you tell us a bit more about what happens with the program?
Yeah, sure. So the program ran every single Monday afternoon, and essentially you would go to the law building with a bunch of other UCID law students, and there you would be paired up with a refugee participant, and then you'd go through with them their English lessons, and that might be looking at their ESL test or their high school English test or their citizenship test.
The program seems like such a unique alternative to traditional after-school tutoring that most of us might engage in. So why did you choose to get involved with this program?
I think for me, it was really actually a personal passion. So I personally am quite passionate about refugee rights and advocacy, and that comes from being from an immigrant background. It is something that lands very close to my heart. And so the type of people that you meet throughout this program actually are quite reminiscent of my own parents and my own grandparents back in China. So I almost feel like I'm, you know, giving back to the sacrifices that my parents made for me to be here. And it's a really gratifying feeling knowing that you're making quite a positive and tangible impact in someone else's life. And so for me, it was the ability to have a meaningful project throughout university. But in line with that, I've also had a bit of background in tutoring and volunteer work. So all of those interests really aligned together.
Yeah, I think a lot of students can relate to your motivations for joining. So I, for one, can definitely understand how you felt, especially given that my parents immigrated to Australia during the 1980s. Back then, learning English was such a big challenge to them, especially since they were already well into adulthood by then. So it was quite a challenge for them to pick up a whole new language and adapt to a different culture while on top of balancing a job and raising a family. So can you elaborate a bit more about what kinds of backgrounds the students came from?
So the students come from a range of different backgrounds in terms of age and also their cultural background. So you could have students as young as 15, 16 who are in high school, or students who are as old as, you know, perhaps your parents or your grandparents who have just come over as refugees and are looking to sit their citizenship test. But in terms of cultural backgrounds, you have people from all over the world, from all different walks of life. So you have people from, you know, Asia, people from the Middle East, who have been through quite some harrowing experiences in their life, because a lot of the time they're fleeing their home country because there's conflict there or because it's no longer safe for them to live there. And so it's very interesting hearing about their personal life stories as well.
I guess it can be expected that the students would come from quite diverse backgrounds and ages. So is there anyone specific who really stood out to you?
Yeah, so I spent a majority of my time with one particular student, and he fled his home country because there was conflict there and it was no longer safe for his family to live there. And he was someone who was super inspiring to me. Every single week that I saw him, it was an incredibly humbling experience, just seeing someone who has been dealt arguably quite unlucky you know, cards in life and still come every week with a huge smile on his face and huge motivation to just learn more from me and also about my life as well. And, you know, he really wanted to become a doctor. And so we would often talk about things outside of our English lesson, like about life and university and, you know, the professional world and work. So I felt like he was actually a good friend of mine by the end of the program. And to this day, we still keep in contact. So whenever he has a huge achievement, he'll text me or email me. And it's just a very gratifying feeling knowing that I've been able to make a positive impact in his life.
That's so inspiring to hear. So best of luck to your student, and hopefully we can see him join us at UCID. It seems like this was quite a unique experience for you. So did you face any challenges with communication?
Yeah, definitely. I think at the very beginning, there is the obvious challenge that they are not fluent in English, so there's a language barrier, but also that they come from a different background too, so there's also a bit of a cultural barrier as well. But for me personally, it wasn't a huge challenge just because I've spent a lot of my life interacting and being around people from a lot of different cultures, and a lot of that has just derived from the fact that I come from an immigrant family and a lot of our family friends are from different cultures as well. But for anyone who hasn't had the same experience as I have and been able to interact with a range of different people, I think that this program is actually something that could be very, very beneficial for you to get exposure and learn how to communicate and get along with and form relations with different types of people.
Yeah, definitely. It's so valuable to be able to meet people who have had such different life experiences to you and learn to truly connect with them on a deeper and more personal level. I can see how this might be a bit of a challenging process. So could you tell us a little bit more about what you learned during the program?
Sure. I think, you know, I definitely felt like I got a lot of value from this program, and a lot of what I learned was actually centered around my soft skills. And so that looks like your communication skills, your relationship management skills, and also just building a lot of empathy and staying very humble throughout your law school journey. So in terms of communication, that's incredibly important for your academic and also your professional career. Being able to interact with people who, you know, might not be as fluent in your primary language, who are from a different background, inevitably builds very strong communication skills. And also in terms of relationships, I think, you know, a lot of the tutors who did this program ended up being quite good friends with their refugee students. And so I actually think that it's a program that you can go to widen your social network in terms of making new friends and broadening your group of people you know beyond the people that you know at university who might be from very similar backgrounds to yourself. But on the last point, in terms of empathy and humbleness, I think, you know, it's a program that definitely keeps you grounded. It definitely makes you check your privilege and check your priorities. You spend the whole week, you know, stressing about your law assignments, stressing about your marks, stressing about what lecture I'm up to and all the readings that I haven't done. But then you come to this lesson and you realize that life is way more than the marks and the readings that you've done at university, and law school can be incredibly stressful with a lot of pressure. So I think this is a great mechanism for you to stay grounded and just relieve a bit of stress as well.
Well, you've definitely inspired me to consider becoming a part of the program now. It seems like it gives you quite a good reality check in terms of what's going on in your life and what your priorities should be. So if you could give a piece of advice to someone who's thinking of applying to be a tutor, what would it be?
Look, I think approach this thinking that you're not a tutor, but more so a mentor and a friend to these students. So if you do end up participating in this program, you know, throw your whole self into it. Be active in getting to know the person, getting to know their life story, and actually forming like a legitimate relationship with them, because it is really rewarding. And what you'll get out of this program is quite similar to what you put into the program.
That's such a good way to look at it, and it's great that the program has been a wonderful learning experience for you. So thank you so much for coming today to share your experiences with us, and I'm so glad to hear that you've been able to have such a meaningful experience at university.
Thanks, Kathy. I've loved talking to you today. And, you know, to anyone that's listening that is thinking of applying, I would definitely encourage you to do so. It has been one of the more pivotal and enjoyable parts of my university life, and I think that, you you know, it's something for everyone. You shouldn't be scared of, you know, not being able to connect with the students or having a different background. It's definitely something that would be rewarding for, I think, anyone.
So, on the episode today, we've heard some wise insights from Professor Simon Rice and talked about the SLIC program, volunteering for JJMS and being a tutor for the Refugee Learning Program. I think it's safe to say a lot of us bright-eyed law students enter law school aspiring to change the world and make a difference. Yet somehow there's a common thread of law students becoming slowly disillusioned with human rights or making a difference and instead gravitating towards corporate law as a secure career pathway. We hope this episode gave you some insights on some meaningful programs you can get involved in now while you're in university and have the time to explore your options. There's no right career path in law, only the one you're willing to carve out. And as Professor Simon Rice said, remember to be brave.